from KQED. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim, in for Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum, Neil Katyal joins us to tell us why he thinks President Trump has left Congress with no choice but to remove him from office. Katyal is former acting U.S. Solicitor General and a celebrated Supreme Court lawyer who has taught impeachment dozens of times as a law professor at Georgetown. As the House prepares to vote on impeachment this week, Katyal will take your questions. Then we'll close out the hour with Colorado Senator and Democratic presidential candidate Michael Bennett as part of Forum's coverage of the 2020 election. We'll get his thoughts on the impending Senate impeachment trial and why he's running for president. That's all next. Join us. Welcome to Forum. I'm Mina Kim, sitting in today for Michael Krasny. Neil Katyal was the acting Solicitor General under the Obama administration and has argued more cases before the U.S. Supreme Court than any other attorney of color. He runs a celebrated Supreme Court practice, and his deep knowledge and experience in constitutional and criminal law have made him a go-to commentator on every major news program, though most often on MSNBC. Katyal believes Congress has no choice but to impeach and remove President Trump, and he lays out his reasons in his new book, Impeach: The Case Against Donald Trump. Welcome to Forum, Neil Katyal.
Thank you so much. I'm a big fan of the show, so it's great to be here with you.
Well, it's great to have you with us. And before we get to your legal analysis of the impeachment case against Trump, I have to ask when you decided to write this. I mean, we've only been deep in the throes of impeachment for a few months, and it takes a while to write and publish a book.
So believe it or not, the whole idea of the book just came up on October 4th and then wrote it over the next 2 weeks and got it on shelves 3 weeks later. And it was a kind of crazy story. So I have the privilege of teaching at Georgetown, and I teach impeachment. I've taught it 20 times. So I kind of know the law. And over the time with Mueller, I kind of felt like being just a law professor wasn't enough, like writing scholarly articles. I wanted to try and tell people how bad what Trump was doing was. And so I started to do TV for that reason. And I realized that that TV was such a spin machine that there was very little chance to actually convey the truth and have it resonate with people during Mueller, particularly once Attorney General Barr falsely summarized what the Mueller report said. And so all of that was in my head when the Ukraine scandal broke, and it broke, I think, on the night of September 19th. And I wrote an op-ed the next day with my friend George Conway in The Washington Post saying this is really serious and I think is going to lead to impeachment. And when I wrote that with George, we got a lot of pushback from people, including so-called impeachment experts, saying that's ridiculous, never allow it, blah, blah, blah. And by the end of those 2 weeks, by the dinner on October 4th, which I was having with just a bunch of friends, it was very clear that impeachment was very much a possibility. So I went around with my friends, just a bunch of people, and said, hey, what do you think I should do? And my friend Howard Yoon, who is a top book agent, he said, well, you're going to hate this advice, but I really think you should write a book. And I said, Howard, there's no way I could write a book. I mean, this would need to come out really fast. And he's like, you can do it. And particularly if you have a great collaborator. And I did have a great collaborator, a friend of mine named Sam Koppelman. And so that night I went home, banged out a proposal in 2 hours, sent it to the publishers and said, anyone who can, get this thing on the shelves in 3 weeks, we're going to go with you. And we fortunately have an amazing publisher in HCO. So that's the story.
And you mentioned that you wrote your original op-ed with George Conway, who is, of course, Kellyanne Conway's wife, husband, and she is the White House. She's an advisor in the White House. And you also go to great pains to say at the outset of your book that you're nonpartisan. And Neil Katyal, I mean this totally respectfully, but why should readers believe you? I mean, I know you say that you are not a partisan, but if you worked for the Obama administration, contributed to Democratic campaigns, I mean, those are not things that scream neutral.
Right. No. So my point is not, you know, look, I've worked for two Democratic administrations and so on. So I'm not saying I don't have political views, as do I think most Americans. They have political views. When I say nonpartisan, I mean my approach to the law is very much and has always been nonpartisan. And the way I think about it is, you know, what I teach my first day law students. They come in, they all have their biases. Some want to rule for corporations, some want to rule for the little guy, some for women, some for this, that, whatever have you. And what you always teach them is, you know, flip the parties, like pretend you're representing the other side. How would you do so? What do you think about the arguments on the other side, having to make them and advance them? And, you know, that's just a central idea of what law is, that justice is blind. You know, literally, Lady Justice is blindfolded in the sculptures. And what I'm trying to do in this book is to say, look, right now it's a Republican president accused of these things, but it could have been a Democratic one. And your answer shouldn't change just because of your political preferences. That is to say, ask yourself, if Obama had done what Trump did, try and cheat on an upcoming presidential election with the help of a foreign government, would you be okay with that? Would you say that's someone we can keep in as president? And that's the whole approach of the book, is to say central to legal questions is this idea of it doesn't matter who the party is, it's what they did. And here, what they did, and the book goes into some detail about this, is so egregious that I don't see any other choice but to impeach and remove this president.
So then let's get to your legal analysis. And first of all, you do frame it in terms of how the founders approached this question. And I was struck by how some of the folks at the Constitutional Convention didn't even feel like an impeachment clause was necessary.
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, when in the Philadelphia Convention, it's a hot summer in 1787, and they leave impeachment mostly toward the end. They're hammering out kind of the great big powers of the government. And one of the first things they do is they say, look, we really want to have a strong president. And, you know, Hamilton, others really speak in favor of that. Ultimately, Hamilton called it the advantages of secrecy and dispatch that would be given to the executive, that they could act quickly. So you have a strong president. But then as the convention dragged on, people realized, well, what we need some sort of check on that. And so some proposed impeachment. And other founders like Elbridge Gerry said, no, we don't need to have impeachment in the Constitution because we have reelection campaigns. And indeed, this is before the constitutional amendment limiting terms to two. So, you know, presidents could be seeking reelection, you know, ad infinitum. So Gerry said, we don't need to have impeachment in the Constitution. And then others like Madison and Hamilton said, well, wait a minute. What if you have a president who abuses the public trust? What if you have a president who tries to cheat in an election? And indeed, others were even said, what if you have a president who's beholden to a foreign government? And so all of those things lead even Elbridge Gerry to switch and say, yes, we do need to have an impeachment clause in the Constitution. But the Philadelphia history is really interesting because what it does is it really reveals, if you were to ask the founders, what's like the best example of an impeachable offense, a high crime and misdemeanor? It'd basically be what the president did in Ukraine. It has all of the elements. It has abuse of power in putting the people's interests behind those of the president's personal interests. And it involves a foreign power, which is something the founders were so concerned with. The Emoluments Clause, the Natural Born Citizens Clause in the Constitution, saying, you know, you have to be a natural born citizen to be president. All that stuff is in there because they were so paranoid about foreign influence. And here now you've got a president who goes off and seeks help from another government. And so that's what makes, I think, that part of the allegations so damaging. There's a whole separate side about obstruction of Congress that we can talk about as well. But just on Ukraine specifically, it does seem to me that this is exactly the kind of example the founders had in mind.
We're talking with former acting U.S. Solicitor General Neil Katyal about the impeachment case against President Donald Trump. And as the House prepares to vote on impeachment this week, what are your questions for Neil Katyal? Give us a call at 866-733-6786. Again, 866-733-6786. Post your comments on Facebook, Twitter, email us at forum@kqed.org. One of the things also that I appreciated in your book was that you define what constitutes impeachment as best you can, because they are broad categories, treason, bribery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors. But in particular, you describe what high, in terms of high crimes, meant to the founders.
Yeah, so when I teach impeachment, my students always come in and they think high crimes. That must mean a serious crime, like not like jaywalking or something like that. But it's actually not high in terms of serious, and it's not even crime. So, you know, it can take them both as the book does. So, first of all, you don't need to commit a crime in order for something to be impeachable. You know, if the president woke up and decided to nuke Canada or something because he was upset with Justin Trudeau, I'm not sure that there's a criminal statute that would violate a criminal law. But it would obviously be an impeachable offense. It'd be a grave error in judgment. So that's, you know, that's to say crimes aren't necessary. They're also not sufficient. And we know this because of one of the most celebrated, or at least now celebrated, incidents of our founding, when you had Vice President Burr, Aaron Burr. He's a sitting vice president, and he shoots and kills Hamilton in a duel. And if you haven't seen the play, go see it. It's amazing. But, you know, that after Hamilton is shot and killed, Burr is not impeached. Nobody thinks that's impeachable. They think it's a criminal act, maybe, but they don't think it's an impeachable offense. Why isn't it an impeachable offense? Well, because it wasn't an offense against the state, against the American people. It was effectively a private crime. And so when you see the word high in the phrase high crimes and misdemeanors, it's actually meant to signify it's a crime against the state, against the government, mm-hmm. against the American people, as opposed to an individual crime, a burglary or something like that. And so that's why it's in there. At the same time, the founders did want to have something of a high standard, of a strong standard. They didn't want impeachment for just any ordinary lapse in judgment, even one that might have, you know, unintentionally harmed the public in some way. They wanted it to be serious. And here in the book, and it's on page one of the book, I refer to a congressman sitting in 2008 who said, you know, this business of high crimes and misdemeanors, what is it? Well, it boils down to one simple thing. Has the president put his own personal interests above those of the American people? Has the president put his own personal interests above those of the American people? The man who said that was a congressman named Mike Pence, now obviously the vice president. And I call that the Pence standard in the book, and I think that's exactly the right definition of what is an impeachable offense. And, you know, that's why I find the Ukraine allegations so troubling. That's why you had 12 witnesses come forward, including people who are Trump administration appointees, saying what was going on here was wrong. It was the withholding of foreign military aid appropriated by the Congress, paid for by the taxpayers, that was supposed to be in the national interest, and he held it up not for anything but his own personal agenda. And, you know, the president has said, oh, I did it because of corruption. Of course, he doesn't say corruption. He says Biden on the transcript that he released. And the idea that this president, you know, all of a sudden woke up caring about corruption is, I think, a tough one, given the fact that he can't name any other country on earth in which he cared about corruption. And if you did care about corruption, you know, I had the privilege of serving twice at the Justice Department in high positions. I'll tell you, there's no way you go send your private attorney to go and do this work. You send the Justice Department with all of the powers and authorities and treaties, mutual legal assistance treaties and the like, to go and investigate. You don't go and send some private rogue agent to do so. And the last thing I'd say about this is you certainly don't go and ask just for the announcement of an investigation, which is what Trump asked for. He didn't even ask for the investigation. He asked for it to be announced on CNN. That is, to put it mildly, an unusual way to carry out a law enforcement investigation. It's a detrimental way, after all, because when you're carrying out an investigation, you don't want to tip off the suspects. You want to carry it out quietly, not out on CNN.
So if the argument is so clear to you that the president has committed impeachable offenses, what is your reaction to the fact that the argument basically by Republicans is that he did do some things that were unseemly or inappropriate, but not impeachable? I mean, that seems to be, while there have been lots of different arguments, that's one of the key ones that they seem to be grabbing and putting forward.
Right. So, and that's why I wrote the book, to really say, is that really right? And ultimately, I believe that when folks hear that argument, they have to really ask, if it were a president of a different party, what would I think? Because we're setting standards here. Whatever we do here is going to go for future presidents. And maybe you like this president, but you might not like the next one. And you have to really think about what set of powers you're giving a president. Here you're saying, oh, okay, it's not great, but it's not impeachable. We'll leave a president in office who tried to cheat on his reelection. That's the one kind of cardinal check we have on a president, is reelection, as, you know, that debate we were talking about in Philadelphia in 1787 has. I mean, impeachment is really strong medicine and tough to do. Instead, we have reelections. And if you can allow a president to just get by and do this, well, next time it could be China or Saudi or the UK or whoever. It doesn't matter. The point is, we cease to have a democracy as we know it. And so that's why I hope people read the book, because I really, just to return to your first question, I really think the answers to these questions are not political answers or partisan answers. I think they're fundamentally kind of rule of law, structure of government answers. And we have to ask ourselves, you know, quietly in the mirror, can we really look at ourselves if we say this is okay, that we'll leave this president in office? And that's why I think it's premature. I mean, I know it's a nice Republican talking point right now. Oh, the result of this is obvious and clear. The president is going to be acquitted in the Senate. That's not obvious to me. It's not obvious to me for a couple of reasons. One is, you know, as a litigator, I've seen how processes, trials really shape things. And you think one thing going in, and then very much the narrative can change. Because you're confronted with this. And that may be particularly true here because there's a number of witnesses the president has gagged. In fact, the president has gagged every executive branch employee and every document, every email, every phone call, transcript, anything except the two that he's released. All of that he's forbidden from being turned over to Congress, which no president in our history has done. But some of that evidence is going to come out, I suspect, in the Senate trial, despite the fact he's trying to hide it from the American people. And I do think that can change perceptions. That's number one. And then number two is, you know, you're never confronted with this until you actually have to vote. And there's a lot of talk and hot air. But when people actually have sat through the trial and have to look at themselves and say, is this okay? I think we might get some different answers.
Well, Neil Katyal, I think you're anticipating our listeners' questions because Susan asks, if impeachment fails in the Senate, does that mean the president is above the law? Will we be living in a dictatorship? And John writes, if impeachment fails, won't that just add fuel to President Trump's reelection? Wouldn't it be better for Democrats to ask ourselves what mistakes we made to get him elected in the first place? And Neil Katyal, I mean, their concerns are well-founded. I mean, you have, you know, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell saying that he is working in total coordination with the White House, not just talking with the White House, but working in total coordination with them. You've got Senator Lindsey Graham saying he's already made up his mind, even though these senators are supposed to swear an oath to be impartial, right, and to approach this role in a solemn and open way. And so for many, it's a foregone conclusion that you're not going to get 67 senators to vote to remove.
Yeah, so, I mean, I agree with you that what McConnell has said, that he's going to act in total coordination with the White House, and what Lindsey Graham has said, that his mind's already made up, are both betrayals of the oath that they are to take when they sit in impeachment. And I think it's a very serious problem, what they've done, and demonstrates really an underlying contempt for the rule of law. For them, justice is not blindfolded. Justice is whatever benefits their guy. And I can't think of something more corrosive to the American system. I mean, these folks are actively undoing our American democratic experiment, and they should be held accountable for it. Having said that, one of your questioners was, well, if impeachment fails, it'll just help Trump in the election and so on, and shouldn't we not do that? To me, the case for impeachment is nothing to do with politics, and it may be that we lose, that Democrats lose votes as a result of that, and I don't believe that for a second, but let's just suppose that's right. Fine. I still think that's your duty. I mean, each member of Congress took an oath to uphold the Constitution and laws of the United States. And their duty, I think, requires them to go and pursue this, uncover the facts, uncover all of the stuff that Trump has tried to hide from the American people, and then take a vote. And if the vote fails, yes, it will, you know, Trump will claim victory and so on. But it will be the end of the Republican Party. At that point, they will stand for nothing. If they can't say that this behavior is a problem, then they literally have zero principles except just electing their guy. And the American people, I think, are too wise for that to be all that elections can be about.
Well, let me go to listener Stephen in San Francisco. Hi, Stephen.
Hi. Hey, Neil. I just had a question. You know, I've been practicing law for 30 years and done a number of trials, and the presiding judge has just incredible authority over the process. And I was wondering what your understanding of the role of the Chief Justice as the presiding judge, and particularly as it relates to, you know, the admission of evidence, calling of witnesses, and perhaps his inclination to curb the machinations of Mitch McConnell.
Stephen, thanks. That's a great question. And Neil Katyal, I feel like you are very well positioned to answer this too, because don't you run the same Supreme Court practice that Chief Justice John Roberts did? So how do you think he will preside over this?
Yeah, so, I mean, I've had the privilege of arguing now 40 cases in front of him, and he is such a fair person. Look, I mean, he definitely has made rulings I disagree with, some vehemently, and others that I've agreed with, like healthcare. But I think in every account, it's fairness to law and principle, the kinds of things that we've been talking about for the last half hour. And so I do think that's how, you know, he will approach the job. He'll also approach the job, I think, with a light touch. Chief Justice Roberts himself clerked for the last Chief Justice Rehnquist. They were, you know, he was his law clerk, and Rehnquist presided over the impeachment of Bill Clinton, and I think took a very light touch. So much so that at the end of the whole thing, he said, "I did very little, and I did it very well." I think that will be the Chief Justice's basic approach to this. So the Constitution requires him to preside over the impeachment trial of the president, but it doesn't really specify much of his role beyond that.
Yes, and I want to talk with you more about the role of Chief Justice John Roberts after the break. We'll have more with Attorney Neil Katyal. Stay with us. This is Forum. I'm Mina Kim, in for Michael today. Imagine if it had worked. That's how former acting Solicitor General of the United States Neil Katyal begins his book, Impeach, the Case Against Donald Trump. Katyal argues that if President Trump's solicitation of political favors from Ukraine had gone undetected until after the 2020 election, our democracy's legitimacy would have been undermined. As the full House of Representatives prepares to vote on two articles of impeachment, we're taking your questions for Neil Katyal, and the number 866-733-6786, again, 866-733-6786. You can also post them on Facebook, Twitter, or email them to forum@kqed.org. And Neil Katyal, I just want to ask that second part of Stephen's question earlier, which is whether or not John Roberts, Chief Justice John Roberts, would try to manage or contain Mitch McConnell if he felt like he was acting out of political motivations as opposed to legal ones.
Yeah, I don't think the Chief Justice is going to try and get into anyone's head and guess what their motivations are, but he is fundamentally a rule of law person. And so I do think that we will see decisions based on that. And, you know, I suspect a view that more information to the American people is better than having it hidden. I think we'll probably, you know, see some of those themes as well. So, you know, time will tell. I do think if I were the president, I wouldn't want to have someone like the Chief Justice presiding over my trial, because this is a guy who fundamentally does believe in law, has dedicated his life to the rule of law. And I think what President Trump's actions are doing here, not just in terms of trying to cheat on the election, but also then hiding all of these witnesses and documents, are fundamentally inconsistent with the rule of law.
And just as a follow-up, Kathleen writes, given Mitch McConnell and Lindsey Graham's betrayal of their oath to be impartial, does Justice Roberts have the authority to require them to recuse themselves from the Senate trial? Of course, that was also a call by some Democrats.
Yeah, I haven't looked into the range of the Chief Justice's authorities, but I will tell you that in general, the way impeachment proceedings have run in the past is that the Chief Justice can make rulings, but 51 senators can overrule the Chief Justice's decision. Now, I think that would be very hard when you have a Chief Justice like this who's so deeply respected. But you know, that is available to them. And, you know, the Republicans in the Senate have done things that I never thought I would see in my lifetime, like the examples we've just been talking about, like the Senate Majority Leader saying, I'm going to do everything in total coordination with the White House, and he's going to be acquitted 100%, or what Senator Graham said. I mean, these are, you know, deeply, deeply violative of our most foundational principles as a country.
Well, Wendy tweets, what options do the Senate Democrats have to force Mitch McConnell's hand on the conduct of the trial? And of course, we had Senate Democratic Leader Chuck Schumer laying out his plan, wanting to seek testimony from Mick Mulvaney, John Bolton, other White House officials, get additional documents. I mean, what are the chances that we're going to have those witnesses in this?
I think very high. I mean, I don't understand how these witnesses can be hidden from the American people. They are the firsthand witnesses. And of all people, Donald Trump keeps saying the case against him is hearsay. The firsthand witnesses haven't testified. Well, let the firsthand witnesses testify, which includes, you know, Bolton, the national security advisor, and Mick Mulvaney, the acting chief of staff, who's already said, oh, yes, there was a quid pro quo. Get over it. So I suspect these guys have lots of information to provide. And by the way, I'd say one other person who should definitely be called in the Senate by the House impeachment managers is a guy named Donald Trump. Absolutely. I don't understand how we can't, have him before us as the American people. But, you know, he says the call is beautiful and perfect. Let him say it under oath. Let him say all this stuff. And we can test it with the factual record that's been developed.
Well, let me bring Suzanne from Oakland into the conversation. Hi, Suzanne.
Hi. I want to thank the caller. I mean, not the caller, the guest. And pointing out all the things. My comment is just that we, whether or not the Democrats win the impeachment trial, they have to go forward because of the egregiousness of the offenses that have happened. And even if we don't win it, because the Senate has already said we're voting it down, and if they do that, we have to stand up. We, the people, have to stand up to say this is wrong. We have to call it wrong, and we cannot wait until the election, because Republicans have been caught doing things that rigged the election in their favor. And, I mean, Georgia that's evidence of what they've been doing with the redistricting. So we can't just sit back and say, oh, well, we can wait for the election and just vote them out. Well, people's votes haven't been counted, literally, and all the other redistricting that Republicans have been doing. So it's a very corrupt thing that they're doing to the whole process of the experiment of democracy, and it's a danger, and it's getting worse.
Well, Suzanne, thanks for sharing your opinion on this. Neil Katyal, I want to ask you about another, you know, showdown between legislative and executive powers that's happening right now, which is trying to get President Trump's financial records. And I think you thought the Supreme Court would not hear the case related to Trump's tax returns and other financial records because the Court of Appeals decisions were pretty clear, pretty narrow, and pretty uniform. So what is your reaction to the fact that they have agreed to take it, the U.S. Supreme Court?
Right. So the Supreme Court on Friday agreed to take three separate cases coming from New York and D.C., all of which seeks President Trump's financial records from before the time he was president. And in each of the court decisions by the lower courts, they ruled against Trump. They did so with pure smackdowns, but limited smackdowns, just limited to the information at hand and pretty narrow opinions. And so, you know, it certainly was possible to think that the Supreme Court could say, we're not going to hear these cases. That would have been very unusual because I can tell you, having represented the president, when the president asks the U.S. Supreme Court to hear a case, Supreme Court generally agrees. And, you know, it's a very rare thing to have it the opposite. This one I thought might reach the opposite just because the president's legal arguments were, you know, basically written on crayon. They weren't serious legal arguments. So I could see the court having said no to that. But they did on Friday what they've done many times, which is say, yeah, the president has asked us to hear a case. We're going to hear the case. I don't suspect for a second this is good news for the president. And I think that we will be looking at a decision in May or June.
So you don't believe the acceptance by the four justices, forgive me, was based on a sense that they feel like Trump has a legitimate claim that a president should be protected from having to release that information related to a state?
No, I don't. I think that the law here is very, very clear. And, I certainly wouldn't be bringing this case if I were the president. If your goal is to win, I don't think that's is going to happen. I think if your goal is to delay things as long as you can because you're afraid of this information coming out, then you do this and you fight a case all the way to the Supreme Court about your tax returns from before you were president. And by the way, this isn't like these are not documents that are being sought so that you and I and everyone can see them. It's for, you know, Congress to see them and for the New York prosecutors to see them. They're not going to be like on the internet or something like that. And he's saying, I can't even do that.
Well, Michael writes, what do you think of the Democrats' decision not to include the Mueller findings in their articles of impeachment? There was just a sort of reference to them saying that this is, you know, shows a pattern of conduct, that this is consistent with the president's previous behavior when they talked about the charges related to Ukraine. But other than that, they did not specifically cite Mueller's findings.
Right. So I think they did what I advocated in the book, which was to basically have a tight case focused on Ukraine and to have it be about the abuse of power with Ukraine and putting his personal interests above the American people, and then also the obstruction of Congress and the hiding of evidence and documents as the counts. That's what they decided to do. And then you're right, there is a reference, and a very important reference to Mueller and the obstruction and behavior that the president engaged in then. And so that does allow them to introduce the evidence about what happened with Mueller, because Mueller, after all, found 10 different instances in which the president obstructed justice. And, you know, he may have charged them as criminal offenses, but he was precluded by a Justice Department opinion that said you can't indict a sitting president. So he was temporarily cleared on the basis of a legal technicality. And the Democrats have, I think, wisely kept the door open to introduce that evidence should they want to. At the same time, Mueller is basically just gravy. I mean, you don't need Mueller to impeach and remove this president. You've got the president caught red-handed with his hands in the cookie jar, and not just on any kind of minor offense or a technical offense, on really core impeachment activity. Exactly what the founders thought. Cheating in an election, help of a foreign government, all in secret. That's the recipe that our founders had for impeachment. That's what the whistleblower and now the hearings in Congress have revealed, 12 different witnesses, a partial transcript released by the president himself. All of this is tremendously damning to the president, And so I don't think you need to get into questions of Mueller in order to evaluate this case against the president.
Well, let's bring Robert from San Francisco in. Hi, Robert.
Yes, thank you. I'm thinking that what we're not looking at, and for probably reasonable reasons, a decent reason, is that this is the constitutional crisis, actually, that the founding members of our government put in place, that there would be one-party rule. So impeachment becomes irrelevant through one-party rule. If McConnell and Graham can control the Senate and they can stack the courts, which they're attempting to do, that's the actual crisis that we're facing. So it won't matter if another party is in power, theoretically, because the minority would never be able to stop the majority from enacting whatever they choose of legislation or process they want to enact.
Robert,
that's hard to confront. So because the only option that starts raising its ugly head is civil strife.
Robert, I appreciate your comment. And related to that, Neil Katyal, I mean, you talk about your hope, right, that people will come to their senses potentially based in your view, right, and that you're not so sure that an acquittal is a foregone conclusion. But I'm thinking back to the earlier commenter who said, what after this does fail, what do we have? What are we left with? A dictatorship? And even you yourself have talked about how these proceedings have shown just how fragile the Constitution is and how it may not have anticipated such a polarized time, such factions in our government. You know, so at what point do we say this simply doesn't work and our democracy is failing?
Well, I agree with you and with the caller just now that the risks here are very extreme. And I just disagree with dispositionally what that means you do about it. I don't think that means that we just wallow and say, oh, democracy's over and, you know, we all move to another country or something like that. Instead, I think we take comfort in the rich traditions of this country and the American people who've stood up time and again when people have said, oh, things are over, whether it's, you know, 1776 or 1787 or 1863 or the Civil Rights Movement or recently marriage equality, in which people have come together and gotten something done that people thought was impossible. And I do think that's, you know, the American spirit. That's why my parents came here. It's what I'm so privileged to see all the time. It's why people are listening to this show. And they haven't given up. And I think it's such a mistake to say, oh, everything is foreordained and then just what? You go home and do nothing. Instead, I think we gotta, you know, do everything we can to make sure that the questions here are brought to popular attention and debated and understood for what they are, not with spin and chaff, but with what the president did and how bad it is and what the remedy is to that.
Well, Neil Katyal, I know you need to leave us, but that sounds like a good thought to end our conversation on. Thank you so much for being on Forum today.
Thank you. It's been a real privilege.
Neil Katyal, attorney and former acting Solicitor General of the United States, a law professor at Georgetown. He's the author of a new book, Impeach: The Case Against Donald Trump. This is Forum. Stay with us.